All right. Welcome, listeners, to episode 35 of Know Your Enemy. I'm your podcast co-host, Matt Sittman, and I'm here with my great friend, Sam Edler-Bell.
Hi, Matt.
Hey, Sam. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm glad that you said great friend today, given the subject matter of the episode.
Yes. Friendship will be a theme we discuss, and the topic is, well, it's a long time coming. It's one Sam and I mean, Sam, we've talked about this for even before we started the podcast, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're going to talk about Saul Bellow's Roman Aklef titled Ravelstein, which was a late-in-life novel, a novella maybe even of Bellow's, published in the year 2000. And it's more or less a portrait, a fictionalized portrait, of his friend Alan Bloom, who they taught together at the University of Chicago's Committee on Social Thought. Bloom, of course, was a well-known Straussian political philosopher and really kind of vaulted into a new stratosphere of fame and wealth with the publication of his book in 1987, The Closing of the American Mind, which really was like a, you know, early entry into some of the PC culture war stuff in higher education in the late 80s. But really, I think, is a book that transcends that category, which we'll discuss. But that's the topic. Bloom, Bellow, this novella Ravelstein, Bloom's Closing the American Mind, all that will be in the mix, and we're just going to have a lot of fun with it.
Yeah, it's kind of like just catnip for the two of us to discuss these books and these figures, because it touches on so much stuff we talk about in the podcast all the time. Straussians, conservatives, liberal education, liberalism as such, ancients and moderns, Jewishness in particular with Bellow and their friendship as well, the status of love and politics. I mean, come on, this is Know Your Enemy, meat and potatoes.
Yes, it is. And it's also sort of a fitting episode for Pride Month, I was going to say.
Alan
Bloom is not a gay icon, but maybe he should be. Or he at least, we're talking about a complicated gay man in the mix today, too.
That's right.
Well, I don't think we want to detain listeners too long before we get into this, because we have a lot to talk about. Yeah. So let's just do some housekeeping. As always, we're grateful to our partners at Dissent for sponsoring the podcast. They're so great to us, and we enjoy our relationship with them. And very generously, they provide digital subscriptions if you subscribe to the Know Your Enemy Patreon at $10 a month or more. And of course, if you subscribe for $5 a month, you get all of our bonus episodes, the whole back catalog, which I've been pleased that some of our newer listeners have gone back and listened through them and still seem to like them. And we're doing about 2 main episodes a month in front of the paywall and 2 behind the paywall. So if you subscribe, you're going to get to hear Sam and I at least twice more a month most months.
That's right. And of course, we want to thank our brilliant producer, Jesse Brenneman, for making
indeed.
The episodes sound so good. I want to put in a quick plug here for Jesse's new music record, album of music that he created all by himself in a room full of instruments. I don't know how he did it. It sounds amazing. And you can get it on, you know, Spotify and all the platforms. You can buy it on Bandcamp if you want to help Jesse out. It's self-titled. It's called Jesse Brenneman. And generally speaking, it is a expression of his daunting multi-talents that he was able to make this record all by himself.
Yeah. Sort of a deranged one-man band.
That's a great way to describe it. So check that out. And then the music that we play on the podcast, of course, is our friend Will Epstein, who records under the moniker High Water. You'll hear that music very soon. And with that said, I'll say also, please rate and review the podcast. We do love
that. Oh, yes.
That
is helpful. Yeah, please do that.
Helpful for our egos and helpful for, I don't know, our SEO or something.
The algorithm.
That all said, please enjoy Ravelstein, Saul Bellow, Alan Bloom, the long-awaited conversation.
All right, listeners, thanks again for tuning in. Why did I say that? Thanks again for tuning in. What the hell is that shit? All right, Sam, do you want to really dive in? Are you ready?
Let's do it. Let's wade into the waters. Wade into the capital G, great, capital C conversation.
That's right. This podcast, unlike our other episodes, you know, really is a part of a conversation that's occurred across the ages.
Yes.
You know, between the great, the towering men of intellect. There's no history, no context. You just move from Plato and Aristotle to Machiavelli. You know, maybe you make a pit stop at Thomas Aquinas or Augustine along the way. Then you follow the waves of modernity until they inevitably crash down on our own heads.
Locke, Spinoza, Leibniz, Newton. Right. On and on they come.
So as we mentioned in the intro, we're going to talk about Saul Bellow's late Romanoclef, Ravelstein, you know, more or less about Alan Bloom, although there's some dispute about some of the details. And of course, it is a fictional recreation of sorts. So, you know, it's not a one for one, but for our shorthand will be that Ravelstein's about Alan Bloom. And it's really a chance for us to talk about Bloom, who's a very important figure in American intellectual life the past, you know, 40 or 50 years. He plays an important role on the right. His book, The Closing of the American Mind, which we'll talk about, which was published in 1987, that was a really important book. It's one conservatives still talk about and argue about. And it was an important intervention in some of the debates about higher education that really were, I think, ramping up in the 80s. The kind of first wave PC scare of sorts, you might put it.
And then the nice thing about the structure of this is that Ravelstein basically, it takes place primarily in the aftermath of Bloom having sold this book and made millions of dollars and become an intellectual superstar. Obviously, Bellow and Bloom's friendship preceded that for some number of years. In fact, Bellow encouraged Bloom to write this book, you know, this sort of popularizing of his ideas, of his particular idiosyncratic, very Leo Strauss-influenced ideas about liberal education. But the way we can approach this conversation is sort of give a sense of who Bloom and Bellow are and how they are connected. Then we can talk about Closing a bit, Closing the American Mind, and then we can move on to Ravelstein, which is sort of, it's in chronological order.
Yes. And of course, along the way, we'll probably weave a lot in and out. But, I, you know, Sam, I was thinking too, one of the funny things is by focusing so much on the West Coast Straussians and the Claremont Institute and Harry Jaffa, that is, in a way, offers a distorted vision, I think, of Straussianism.
Yes, I agree.
In the sense that it's one faction among Straussians and probably not the most important in the political theory world.
Yeah.
Like, their importance is to practical American politics in some ways. But among academics, I mean, my sense was, as someone who used to run in the Straussian circles, you might call me a Straussian fellow traveler in my graduate school days, that the West Coast Straussians were not, they were taken a bit unseriously by some of the other Straussians. Not dismissed or like, it's not like I heard slurs all the time about how dumb the West Coast Straussians were. It's not that at all. But I just mean there's a difference between kind of churning out somewhat propagandistic accounts of the American founding than, say, Harvey Mansfield spending years translating Machiavelli's histories or something.
Right. And Bloom translated Rousseau and Plato.
Bloom's translation of Plato, Plato's Republic, is probably the one, if you encounter it in an undergraduate course, it's one of the translations you're probably likely to encounter. And he also translated, I mean, among other things, Rousseau's Emile.
I mean, for him, these are the two essential books about education, among other things, which we'll get to when we talk to about Closing. Yeah, no, that's a really good point about the Straussians, and I think the benefit of this episode for the listeners is they'll get some more East Coast Straussianism in the mix. And it's something we've referred to in the past, but I'll just put it out there so people have it in mind, that the West Coast Straussians, especially like sort of after people like Jaffa, you know, made their intellectual name with his big book about Lincoln, the founding of like the Claremont Institute and the real practical engagement with politics that the West Coast Straussians engaged in was, like you're saying, a much more sanguine and ambivalent account of the American founding, but it also was much more confident in and allied with the sort of social conservative nationalist Christian impulses in the conservative movement. Whereas, as we've probably said before, the East Coast Straussians, insofar as some of them did engage practically in politics, they were more like neocons, right? They were not so socially conservative, not so sympathetic to anything that smelled of populism. They'll work in the State Department and try to shape the regime at home and abroad, but you know, they're not like making common cause with the Christian right to try to reshape the moral order of America.
That's so true. And, you know, again, all this is complicated. I mean, if you look at back issues of the Claremont Review of Books, kind of pre-Trump, you know, you would see Harvey Mansfield in its pages, or he's still in their pages.
He's it. I have my first, I've subscribed to Claremont Review of Books. As I joked on Twitter, this is what our Patreon money is going to, my subscribing to many conservative publications. and Harvey Mansfield has an essay in the latest Claremont Review of Books.
Right. So it's possible to overemphasize the differences. I mean, but the Claremont Review of Books has always been, I think, sort of one of the outlets where Straussians write for a public audience.
Right.
You know, kind of between a magazine like National Review and a peer-reviewed academic journal.
Yeah.
So at least in the print magazine over the years that I've been reading it, there's, you know, you'll see Straussians of all types. So you can overemphasize the differences. But again, I just thought I'd say at the start that I mean, I'm sure some listeners think, okay, so Matt and Sam have demolished the West Coast Straussians, and yet Matt still says he was a Straussian fellow traveler.
Why?
When he was in grad school. Why? It's because, you know, the way I encountered Straussianism was not through the West Coast Straussians.
Yeah.
The Straussians I knew best were, I mean, to be honest, Harvey Mansfield. I spent a lot of time with him back in the day. Jim Caesar at the University of Virginia. Someone like Dan Mahoney, a kind of Catholic Straussian-ish figure at Assumption College. That's just to say the West Coasters were not my introduction to Straussianism. And in some ways, I'm not sure they even best represent it.
Yeah.
If you're going back to the thought of the master himself, Leo Strauss.
Right.
Beyond those preliminaries, I think we should just give a sense of who these people were.
Sure.
Bloom and Bellow, like when they were alive, where they taught, so on and so forth.
Go for it.
So Bloom was born September 14th, 1930. He's a Virgo like me.
Oh.
And he died in October 1992. So he died fairly young, about 62, 63 years old. He did his PhD at the University of Chicago under Leo Strauss. He studied in Paris. He taught at Yale, Cornell, the University of Toronto, and then returned to Chicago in 1979 to teach at the University of Chicago's Committee on Social Thought. And it was the University of Chicago connection where he, I think, forged at least some of his friendship with Bellow.
Yeah.
Bellow, of course, was older than Bloom. That kind of figures into Ravelstein a bit. He was born 15 years earlier in 1915 and died in 2005. So Bellow outlived Bloom by,
13
over
years.
A decade. Bellow, of course, it's funny. He's such a quintessentially American writer.
Yeah.
Right. Especially an American Jewish writer. But he was born in Quebec. And didn't move to Chicago until he was 9. And I think the story goes he didn't find this out until he tried to sign up for the draft during World War II.
Uh-huh.
And of course, Bellow, I mentioned he was, you know, a kind of a famous American novelist. He won the Pulitzer Prize, Nobel Prize, and 3 times won the National Book Award. He also went to the University of Chicago briefly as an undergraduate, then went to Northwestern. And he didn't study, this is funny, he didn't study English in the literature department because he said it was anti-Jewish.
I believe it.
Which really would have was common in English departments at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because it's how can these swarthy Yiddish speaking foreigners understand our native tongue kind of deal? And that's something that Lionel Trilling experienced at Columbia too.
Yeah.
So instead, Bellow studied anthropology and sociology, moved to New York. He also ended up back at the Committee on Social Thought in 1962. So he arrived there a bit earlier than Bloom, but they would have overlapped, you know, for a couple decades at the committee. They lived on the same block. They talked almost every day. They really seemed to be about as close as friends as two men can be.
Yeah. And this is, I mean, we'll get into this a lot in Ravelstein, but it's a late in life friendship for both of them. You know, at a time when men are not supposed to make such close friends anymore. And I think that something that struck them both about their relationship was how close they became so quickly. It wasn't so long. I mean, I don't think that they weren't friends in the 60s and 70s, as far as I know. They really became friends in the years leading up. Yeah, in the 80s, in the years leading up to Bloom writing Closing. But yeah, no, ultimately, Bloom moved into an apartment building right next door to Bellow. Bellow has talked about how he could see into Bloom's apartment and see if the light was on, whether he could give him a call. and in the period after Bellow's divorce from his fourth wife, I think, Alexandra, who figures under another name in Ravelstein, after that divorce, there was a period of time where Bellow and Bloom were having dinner together 2 or 3 times a week. And Bloom referred to it in an aside to a friend once as the period of time when, quote, Saul and I were married.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, we've jokingly referred to each other as the other's podcast husband.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of get what they mean in a way.
And we are having dinner together tonight, Matt.
With our significant others, I should say.
Yes.
Just a couple other. I wanted to say one thing about the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago, because it's a storied program. It was a bit of a Straussian readout, not totally.
But Strauss taught there.
Strauss did teach there, yes. It was a definite Straussian foothold, especially at the Committee on Social Thought, because it was founded in 1941. I looked this up because I just was curious. It was founded in 1941 by a few people at the University of Chicago. The historian John Neff, I think, who it's named after, but this will interest Know Your Enemy readers too. Frank Knight, the conservative economist, who we probably mentioned his name once or twice in our discussion with Marshall Steinbaum.
Yeah.
About Chicago School. Yeah. Robert Redfield, who was an anthropologist, and then the University of Chicago president, Robert Maynard Hutchins. And the aim of the committee was to, quote, foster awareness of the permanent questions at the origin of all learned inquiry.
Right.
So that emphasis on permanent questions, even though it was formulated before Strauss arrived, feels very Straussian. And it's like an interdisciplinary program. And I think, you know, that was well suited to Straussians, because we know, like, Bloom also wrote a book on Shakespeare's politics. Yeah. And it's very common for Straussians to mix in literature and philosophy. And, you know, is a Straussian a political theorist or a classicist or a philosopher?
Right.
You know, it's the disciplinary boundaries blur, I think, more than even is otherwise common among Straussians. So that's the University of Chicago Committee on Social Thought.
One interjection is that ultimately one of Bloom's major complaints about the nature of the university in the time he was writing Closing was that that interdisciplinarity, though he wouldn't describe it that way, was being destroyed. You know, that everything was being moved into its individual silos, and the sort of broad philosophical task of pursuing capital T truth was being fragmented into all of these narrow disciplines that could only hold, you know, some part of the elephant and not see the whole thing.
And I've known a number of people who've done their doctorates at the Committee on Social Thought, and they're always kind of an interesting bunch. I mean, like, it's a shame, because in terms of, like, getting academic jobs, the interdisciplinary nature hurts, I think, its graduates.
Right.
Especially as, you know, the academic job market has just deteriorated even more.
Yeah.
There was a day when that wasn't the case. But if you're wondering why both Bloom, you know, translator of Plato and Rousseau, a political philosopher, was teaching there, and Saul Bellow, this novelist, that was actually very Chicago,
right?
Very Committee on Social Thought. Like, that was common. Jam Coetzee taught there too.
Yeah.
And I think you see this is part of Bloom and Bellow's friendship, the novelist and the philosopher. They were two brilliant men working out of different traditions, using different categories. One thought like a philosopher and one thought like a novelist.
Right.
And so they play off each other in interesting ways too.
Yeah. And that's a big subject of Ravelstein, which we'll talk about more. I wanted to say one other thing, which is maybe the listeners have put it together, but they're also, though, of course, as you know, Bellow didn't actually move to Chicago until he was 9 years old. Both of them are, in their maturity and most of their childhood, Jewish men of the Midwest. Though, of course, for Bloom, his biography before the moment that he arrives at University of Chicago is so unimportant to him. You know, he writes in Closing, he says, "When I was 15 years old, I saw the University of Chicago for the first time and somehow sensed that I had discovered my life."
Yes.
And that line is just so crucial to understanding his preoccupations and why he would end up having the career that he did, which is primarily as a teacher, in addition to the sort of the intellectual and translation work that he did, but primarily as a teacher, and then writing a book like Closing of the American Mind.
I mean, we can talk about this as we go along, but it's even on the question of their Jewishness, there are interesting differences between Bloom and Bellow.
Yes.
You really get the sense with Bloom, like in true Socratic or Platonic fashion, like transcending the particulars of his upbringing was what enlightenment meant, or what, you know, the search for truth required.
Yeah.
You know, the University of Chicago is such an interesting place, in part because it's, you know, one of the best universities in the country, in the world, in the Midwest. Because I think, too, for a while, they had like an early enrollment program. You know, you hear like Susan Sontag went there when she was very young.
Yeah.
As well. And, you know, they kind of encounter the University of Chicago as this, you know, mecca of culture and learning in the staid Midwest, and I think especially if you're Jewish, it holds even more allure, right? Because you're not, you don't fit in the same way in the Midwest.
Yeah. Richard Rorty was in Bloom's class at University of Chicago. He was a classmate, which is only kind of notable because he becomes, for Bloom, a major antagonist.
Oh, yes. I mean, and Rorty, I mentioned earlier, I was close with Jim Caesar at the University of Virginia. Remember, towards the end of his career, Rorty spent a number of years at UVA, mm-hmm. and he and Jim debated publicly a number of times. Straussian versus Rorty.
Yeah.
But when it comes to Bellow and his Jewishness, you almost get the sense that he dives into it
yes.
in his novels, yep. right? Like explores, like they respond to their Jewishness in almost diametrically opposite ways.
Right.
One tries to transcend it. One enters deeper into it to find something there, you might say. I'm not an expert on Bellow's novels. But
no, that's exactly right. And when we do talk about Ravelstein, the status of their counterposed Jewishness and their approaches to Jewish ethics and Jewish metaphysics is a major preoccupation of the novel. I mean, I think the way that Bellow writes the character of Ravelstein, which is to say Bloom, is that though he publicly presented and in his intellectual work was preoccupied primarily, you know, was sympathized with Athens over Jerusalem, and as you say, like thought that like the beginning of liberal education is being liberated from these kind of traditional religious prejudices that you may come into the university with, nonetheless, especially at the end of his life, became preoccupied with the Old Testament and with Jewish metaphysics. And I think that it's implied in the novel that one of the things that attracted him to Bellow from the beginning was that difference between the two of them.
No, that's a great point, Sam. It's something that struck me because I read this first. I first read Ravelstein when I was like 23, 24,
yeah.
you know, over a decade ago now, when I was in graduate school. And, you know, different things strike you at different points in your life when you read books.
Yeah.
And this time, Bloom's hedging almost at the end of the novel.
Yeah.
About life after death.
Yeah.
You know, the persistence of a soul, those kinds of questions, they stood out to me more this time. And it did make me think of the end of Bloom's great essay on the Symposium called The Ladder of Love, which is also included in his book, Love and Friendship, mm-hmm. where he says, this always strikes me when I read this line, where he says a Catholic priest could give a more sensitive description of the human soul than like a Nietzschean.
Yeah.
Right. And so for Bloom, even like there was a way in which at least religious questions can open up into right the biggest questions.
Right. Yes.
Metaphysics,
yes.
The nature of our souls, if we have souls, life after death, the meaning of life, all that.
Well, maybe that's a good turning point to just give the listeners somewhat of a sense of what is in Bloom's big major book that sort of sets off the action of Ravelstein, which is Closing the American Mind. I'll try to give like a very high vantage point overview, and then you can fill in some of the details that you are interested in. Okay. So this book comes out, and it's kind of the product of his many decades of teaching. You know, it's not a work really of political philosophy, except for as synthesis.
Right.
But it's a work about pedagogy. It's a work about how to teach, how to, you know, shepherd souls, you know, as Bellow points out in his novel, and it is in fact the case. Bloom's preferred title for the book was Souls Without Longing.
That's right. In fact, the full title is The Closing of the American Mind, subtitle, How Higher Education Has Failed Democracy and Impoverished the Souls of Today's Students.
Right.
The use of soul is interesting in a number of ways, but he, as you said, he almost called it Souls Without Longing. And one of my old teachers or acquaintances, I guess, because he didn't really teach graduate students at Georgetown, was the late priest, Father Jim Shaw. And Shaw refused to teach graduate students because he said our souls were closed. And he basically, you know, spent 40 years teaching Plato and Aristotle to Georgetown undergraduates. It was a very mm-hmm. charming teacher. But he has the great quip that the working title should have been Longing Without Soul, which is sort of a comment on some of the hedonism, you might say, of, you know, we see in Bloom and maybe a bit of a religious critique too. But I always love that line from Father Shaw.
Right. That is a good line. And it'll make more and more sense to the listeners as we
yes.
go on here. So Closing, I mean, the fundamental critique, the simplest way to describe the critique of Closing is that the modern university, the university as he encountered it in the late 80s, was incompetent in doing what he thought was the most important role of the university, which was liberal education, which involved, as we've sort of alluded to, this great conversation, this engagement with the great thinkers, the geniuses of history, and mostly ancient philosophy and modern European philosophy. There's a few others, you know, stuck in there. But if you were to map out who are the thinkers, you've got mostly ancients and then liberal moderns, then some critics of liberal modernity like Nietzsche. But the point of the university education is to bring these untutored souls and allow them to experience the ecstatic, erotic, even engagement with this great conversation about the pursuit of truth. About capital T truth. And the problem with the contemporary university, in the sort of simplest Cliff Notes terms for Bloom, was the embrace of relativism, value relativism, the idea that we can't know what set of ideas is better than another. There are different cultures that have thought different things at different times. In fact, our liberal attachment to equality requires us not to judge whether one set of ideas derived from some far-flung part of the world are better or worse than the inheritance of Western civilization. That is the fundamental problem for Bloom. You are creating the circumstances for untutored students with their unspecific longings, their prejudices that they might have had from their upbringing. You're creating a space for them to lose all of that, to tear that all away, and allow them to engage in this beautiful period of free inquiry and the pursuit of the highest good and what it means to be alive and what it means to be happy and fulfilled. But you're doing it within parameters, you know.
Yes.
The Western civilization, if you follow this great book's tradition, if you listen to Leo Strauss and you learn from his teachers, you're tutored by his teachers, you will come away with the conclusion that Western civilization is the best thing that ever happened. And part of the problem with the modern university is that it doesn't permit teachers like Bloom to tutor untutored American souls in that way. That's like the overall picture. He also, it's not just the university though, it's the broader culture. And so the structure of the book is the first part is the students. And so he's describing what the students, what they're coming in with. They're deficient in some really profound ways. But overall, you know, his complaint is interesting. It's not that they are overly attached to a set of wrong ideas. It's in fact that they're not attached enough to any particular ideas, that they're easygoing, yes, that they've imbibed this sort of decadent liberal idea that to be a good person in the world, to be a good citizen, is to not feel particularly strongly that you're right about this or that, to have some sort of hostility to the religious prejudices that previous generations of students that Bloom taught. And for him, in fact, and this is very important, that prejudice is not a bad thing for Bloom.
There's a real older sense of that word.
Yes.
Like now we call someone prejudiced, that means they're kind of a bigot. But a prejudice, you know, there's a kind of different sense of the word too that just means kind of like inherited dispositions or judgments about things.
Yeah. Right?
You think this is bad and that's good, and it's a prejudice because it's just kind of something that's been handed down to you. It's not really the product of a lot of reflective
right
thought,
exactly, something you might derive from what your parents tell you, from but more so and especially from what you learn from your religious education. The line from Closing is, this is Bloom, prejudices, strong prejudices, are visions about the way things are. They are divinations of the order of the whole of things, and hence the road to a knowledge of that whole is by way of erroneous opinions about it. Error is indeed our enemy, but it alone points to the truth and therefore deserves our respectful treatment. The mind that has no prejudices at the outset is empty. So one of his complaints about students is that they arrive empty of prejudice. They have this easygoing post-60s liberalism where they don't really care that much about anything, any capital T truths. And for him, he writes, one has to have the experience of really believing before one can have the thrill of liberation. So in a sort of another way to put it is that one has to be stuck inside Plato's cave in order to exit it. and have have the experience of encountering real truth and not just the reflections of truth that are handed down to you by the religious tradition.
Yeah, that's a great point, Sam. And I'm fairly certain this is a line from Leo Strauss. And it's a great line that in modern life, like in contemporary conditions, what Bloom's describing, most of us, most students are in what he called the cave beneath the cave. Mm-hmm. Right? Like to be in the cave is to be prejudiced in a way. And to be even like in a cave further down means you don't even have those to try to wrest yourself free of.
Right.
And you can see for Bloom, I mean, that emphasis on kind of prejudice and mistakes and error.
Yeah.
You can see that, you know, how the Socratic kind of philosophical method there, right? You know, Socrates would go around asking people questions.
Yeah.
So you would start with their errors, their prejudices, common opinion, and then try to transcend it dialectically through, you know, conversation, argument, and debate.
Right.
And so the entire philosophical task, in two senses, is, you know, neutered, according to Bloom, because of this, the combination of multiculturalism, tolerance, diversity, easygoingness, et cetera.
It's rampant sort of overinterpretation of equality.
Yes, relativism, yes. So the prejudices are necessary to the philosophical quest to begin with because they're what you push off of, right? Without them, you don't really have a starting point.
Right.
But then also, the problem Bloom's describing, it's also like the point of the philosophical quest is rendered pointless because there's no truth to search for to begin with.
Right.
So kind of from both ends, Bloom shows the way that his understanding of a great book's education and truly being tutored toward liberation in a way, in the highest sense, you know, the students coming in to universities and colleges today, just they're too easy going to really get a jolt out of,
right?
You know, to kind of jolt into seriousness about certain questions. I wanted to read, I know we said we'd get to Ravelstein later, but I wanted to read one passage from it.
Feel free.
That I think describes the headiness, Sam, of early on when you were describing, you know, Bloom's understanding of education and great books. When I said earlier that, you know, the West Coast Straussians might, they just don't give you a sense of how interesting Straussians are and how one might be seduced by them in a way.
Yes.
This paragraph shows what I mean. It's early in the novel, page 19 of my hardback, but this is just one passage. Bello is, you know, describing Bloom's perspective on display in closing. And he says this. This is what Ravelstein's books and articles had to tell us. He took you from antiquity to the Enlightenment, and then, by way of Locke, Montesquieu, and Rousseau, onward to Nietzsche and Heidegger, to the present moment, to corporate high-tech America, its culture and its entertainments, its press, its educational system, its think tanks, its politics. He gave you a picture of this mass democracy in its characteristic, woeful human product. In his classroom, and the lectures were always packed, he coughed, stammered, he smoked, bawled, laughed. He brought his students to their feet and debated, provoked them to single combat, examined them, hammered them. He didn't ask, where will you spend eternity? As religious the end is near picketers did, but rather, with what in this modern democracy will you meet the demands of your soul?
Yeah, exactly. That's such a great, it's such
great
a great
passage.
Line. You can tell that's exactly what Bloom wanted. There's aspects of Ravelstein you can imagine that are not exactly what Bloom wanted. Bello to write when he asked him to write about him, as at least Bello insists that he did. But that passage, that's how Bloom saw himself.
Yes. To me, that was always one of the most seductive aspects of some of the smartest Straussians I knew, was in fact their ability to like talk about contemporary politics and culture in light of the backdrop of the entirety of Western political thought.
Right.
You know, to move from, as Bello describes there, to move from, you know, the ancients to Montesquieu and then say something about the press today.
Yeah.
It's kind of a heady mix. And when it's done well, you feel like you're being let in on a secret.
Yeah.
Like, oh, as the Committee on Social Thought's founding statement said, the permanent questions, the permanent problems.
Right.
You know, that sense of having a read into human nature, where you understand, despite all the flux and change, there are certain permanent alternatives that human beings have as choices. That's why there's so many dualities in the Straussian world. Ancients, moderns, natural right and history, reason versus revelation, Athens and Jerusalem, right? There's all these binaries, and that sense of choice and permanent dilemmas is really a major feature of Straussian thought. And you can see in the hands of Bloom how powerful and fascinating it is.
Right. And he makes it dangerous. I mean, Straussians make this dangerous in a very simple way, which we've discussed, you and I, quite a lot, which is that Socrates is killed, right? The danger of the true philosophical mind is that they will say something that is a threat, a great threat to the regime. And that for Bloom, in closing, what he wants to preserve and what he sees being lost is the university as a place where philosophizing can happen safely, not entirely safely. But, you know, he writes at some point that his aspiration was for, quote, a society that tolerates and supports an eternal childhood for some, a playfulness that can turn into a blessing for society. In a way, for Bloom, the less instrumentalized the learning is that you get while you're at the university, the more likely it is to be instrumental to preserving democracy.
Yes.
Or if not, yes. Or if not to preserving democracy, you know, the esoteric meaning might be, if not for preserving democracy, then preserving your sense of your ability to shape events, to be a hero in the world, to go and work for the Bush administration and be Paul Wolfowitz, one of Bloom's proteges, and have a great effect on the world. Use your intellect and your concept of virtue and truth to shape the world to your liking. Uh-huh. It's kind of both things, right? This is where the esoteric exoteric is like, and this is where Bloom's thought is conflicted in a way, because on the one hand, he wants to preserve this space of transgression in the university, right? A place where people can ask dangerous questions, the sort of questions that got Socrates killed. And he wants to say that those questions are necessary for the preservation of democracy. And he makes a relatively compelling argument that that is the case. But on the other hand, you can also hear that he's really only talking about, and he's explicit about this, a tiny elite, right? Only the people who end up at these universities, like only the smartest and most, he doesn't say privileged, but in fact, the most privileged people in society. And what his responsibility to them is, to them as students, is to give them the resources to live a full, intellectually fulfilling life in pursuit of the highest goods.
Yes.
Often that overlaps in his mind with, I would imagine, with the pursuits of maintaining liberal democracy. Sometimes it doesn't. And I think that's a kind of tension in Bloom.
There's also, I think you're right in everything you said, Sam, but there's also a way in which, you know, Strauss told the secret about esoteric writing.
Right.
Right. So like we kind of now live in a world where there are freedoms and tolerances and, you know, Strauss could kind of speak the truth in that sense. And you get the sense that for Bloom, the kind of permanent childhood that you mentioned, there's something interesting about that in that it's almost like for liberal democracies, mass democracy, having universities that are kind of set apart is our compromise, right?
Yeah.
So as you're saying, I think with Bloom, you know, if you pick up his book and you read it, I think you're right, Sam, that he's not really talking about educating every single person in the United States this way.
No.
Right? There was something very democratic about Bloom. I mean, he was a Jewish guy from Indiana.
Yeah.
Right? So you could, out of the motley kind of material of, you know, humankind, you don't know where the brilliant philosophers might come from.
Certainly he believed that, yeah.
But once you kind of got there, Bello describes in Ravelstein that Bloom, you know, if you went to study with him or something as a graduate student, he might, after a year, say, sorry, you're not cut out for this.
Yes, yeah.
And abandon them. And they wouldn't be in his circle anymore. You know, so I think you're right that this is more of an elite type of education than you might necessarily pick up on if you just hear us talking about some of these arguments. But I would also say this is where I think there is a Straussian emphasis on, so you have a relatively small band of elites, right? Trained in the permanent things, trained by someone like Bloom. And so when the character of Gorman, aka Paul Wolfowitz, you know, working in the first Bush administration, is calling Bloom on the phone.
In Ravelstein,
yeah, giving him updates about the Gulf War and, you know, what's going on in the Bush administration. You get the sense that for Bloom, the influence, and this gets to your point about, instrumentality of education or versus it not having certain instrumental purposes or values, you get the sense that the influence is almost indirect.
Yes.
Right? A teacher like Bloom keeps alive a certain tradition at a university. One of the people able to hear his message and learn it and learn from him, goes on to not be president or run for office himself, but to be a presence guiding the country, you know, from the upper reaches of the administrative state. And one of the things about Straussians is that they always talk about regimes.
They do.
Right? And certain regimes have certain qualities or characteristics. And so modern mass democracy has a leveling effect, right? A kind of degrading effect, the lowest common denominator. And so the Straussian project, in part too, is to train, you know, elites to keep alive these ideas and these questions, these texts, the study of these texts in a certain way, a certain understanding of human nature, and then use that, right, to kind of realize what our regime needs.
Right.
It needs to be elevated. So this is why, like, war, there is a, you know, you can overplay the Leo Strauss's connection to the Iraq War. But the idea that, well, you know, we're becoming a little too much like Athens, so we need to become a little more like Sparta.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Toughen us up. We need a big project. We need a grand crusade to ennoble us, to lift us up. That's all in the mix too here, I think.
And then there's the danger, like, when we engage in imperial projects, are we in danger of making the mistake that Xenophon describes in his account of Persia, which is not really Persia, right?
Right.
Which is the idea that Cyrus comes to the Persian sort of council of elders and says, like, you guys have all these great ideas. You've been living so great. You've been living high on the hog. But if you're so great, why don't you conquer, you know? So imperial ambition can also be a danger to the regime, but it was one that certainly in the 80s and 90s, and obviously ultimately in the aughts, the East Coast Straussians were less concerned about than the necessity for a little Sparta.
Yes.
But that kind of thing where you, like, look at these ancient texts and you say, and you apply them to these concrete political and military decisions in the present, that's the stuff that is so exciting for these elites. And I think also with Bloom and Wolfowitz, and his sort of circle of students, Bellow sort of talks about how he could be on the phone all day with his people all over the place, you know. And he talks about gossip, and he says, when I do it, it's not gossip, it's social history.
Yes, of course. I've used the phrase, the line on here before. It was actually the same priest who came up with the Longing Without Soul line, Father Shaw, who told me, and he was speaking more to my friend during a conversation, a very gossipy friend. He said, you know, the link between philosophy and gossip is tenuous but real.
Yeah.
And you see why.
Bloom
gossip is
that.
Almost like it's part of the stuff you can work with, right? To understand people and maybe ultimately transcend in a way.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, the way, as you said, it's social history. It's the way the world works. You can't really be in the know without some gossip.
Yeah, exactly. So let me say a few more quick things about what happens in closing, and then we can move on to Ravelstein.
Maybe some of how, like, its impact.
Yeah. Okay. Know. It had some very good reviews in unlikely places, and it then started selling a lot, and it was sort of seen as a book of the times, that it spoke to this problem, this malaise in the university, this problem with students. And I think that we've sort of alluded to this. Like, I think that for conservatives, there were, like, a few parts of it that were the most attractive. And I think some of those parts of it were both the most vitriolic, or at least problematic, but also the least fleshed out. I mean, they may be, like, symptomatically very important, but they weren't, like, the focus of the book. But I'll point to those things because you have to ask, like, why did this book by Alan Bloom, a student of Leo Strauss, a lifelong teacher who is obsessed with the great traditions of liberal education, why did he inspire Dinesh D'Souza to write, like, a much less sophisticated account of, like, the decadence of the liberal university? I think there's a few things to point to here. So just because I don't want the listeners to be like, to not understand why he was so attractive to conservatives too. In the students section, the first section, there are some kind of, like, very, like, get off my lawn opinions, you know?
The boy listening to the Walkman.
Yeah. There's a really wonderful, I mean, hilarious section on rock music, which is sort of the most, like, where you see him sort of being this out-of-touch conservative type. And he writes, this strong stimulant, which Nietzsche called nihiline, you know, nihilism, was for a very long time, almost 15 years, epitomized in a single figure, Mick Jagger. A shrewd middle-class boy, he played the possessed lower-class demon and teenage satyr up until he was 40, with one eye on the mobs of children of both sexes whom he stimulated to a sensual frenzy, and the other eye winking at the unerotic, commercially motivated adults who handled the money. Bloom's basic critique about problem with rock music is that Bloom loves music, right? It's a big part of Ravelstein. But rock music is incapable of sublimating erotic desire, sexual desire, into eros. Because rock music, as he says at some point, everybody knows that the beat of rock music is the beat of sexual intercourse. And so it just forces you tyrannically to think about sex, physical sex, this low bass thing, and not allow you to have the kind of erotic, sublime experience.
True eros.
Because it's important, I think we've suggested this, but it's very important that eros is fundamental to this pedagogical project for Bloom. Uh-huh. But the idea is that you have these students, they're in their teens, and they have all these untutored, naive, sensual longings. And the project of the teacher, the teacher's responsibility, is to shape those untutored erotic desires into a pursuit of truth.
Can I read the Walkman quote?
Oh, yes.
Because it's such a perfect capstone to this. He writes, "Picture a 13-year-old boy sitting in the living room of his family home doing his math assignment while wearing his Walkman headphones or watching MTV. Mm-hmm. He enjoys the liberties hard won over centuries by the alliance of philosophical genius and political heroism, consecrated by the blood of martyrs. He's provided with comfort and leisure by the most productive economy ever known to mankind. Science has penetrated the secrets of nature in order to provide him with the marvelous, lifelike electronic sound and image reproduction he is enjoying. And in what does progress culminate? A pubescent child whose body throbs with orgasmic rhythms, whose feelings are made articulate in hymns to the joys of onanism or the killing of parents, whose ambition is to win fame and wealth in imitating the drag queen who makes the music.
Yeah.
In short, life is made into a nonstop, commercially prepackaged masturbational fantasy."
So you can see why that would appeal to these social conservatives. But on the other hand, it's what his broader project is totally inconsistent with what they think is important in tutoring students and future citizens. You know, what Bloom says later on is, "Education is not sermonizing to children against their instincts and pleasures, but providing a natural continuity between what they feel and what they can and should be. This is a lost art."
Yes. And that's a great line to show the way he's not conventionally conservative.
No, he wants the erotic, he preserved the erotic in the intellectual and educational encounter. I'll just finish out by saying that he says some pretty ridiculous and terrible things about race in the book. You know, black students are a huge problem for him. He says, quote, "There is now a large black presence in major universities, frequently equivalent to their proportion in the general population." That can't be true in 1986. But he says, "But they have, by and large, proved indigestible."
Oof.
Which is a choice word, a man who chooses his word very carefully. And he goes on to say it's not the fault of the white students, it's the fault of the black students. There's a very revealing line where he says, "Just at the moment when everyone else has become a person, blacks have become blacks. I am not speaking about doctrine, although there was much doctrine at the beginning, but about feeling. Quote, they stick together was a phrase often used in the past by the prejudiced about this or that distinctive group. But it has become true, by and large, of the black students." A profound moment of non-self-reflection. Why would you not just be, again, doing the same thing that other people have said about previous groups? You know, when you were young, they said, the Jews stick together. It's not our fault that we're not integrating them. It's their fault for having their, like, specific prejudicial ways, their desire to stick together. But he doesn't see that as a possibility with black students in the 1980s. He thinks they're sticking together out of some kind of anti-liberal impulse towards identity politics. You know, he writes later, "The heat is under the pot, but they do not melt as have all other groups," speaking of black students. And he blames, of course, the corruptions of the radical part of the civil rights movement, similar to what we've described about the West Coast Straussians in the 1776 project.
Yes, it is telling and frankly not surprising that Bello picks up on that too in Ravelstein.
Yeah.
And one of the scenes that caught my eye, I thought of it while you were reading some of this, is, it's a great scene. Because it turns out that Bloom and his Asian-American boyfriend, Nicky, Abe and Nicky in the novel, love the Chicago Bulls.
Oh, yeah.
And Bloom has like graduate students, his students over to watch games, and they order pizza. And it's kind of a great scene because the Bloom's, you know, love for luxury and the descriptions of how finely appointed his apartment was, right? And then the boxes of pizza and paper plates.
Yes, yes.
As Bloom's kind of walking around with the cordless telephone in his pocket, waiting for a call from Paul Wolfowitz, they're eating pizza. Bello even likens Bloom to Michael Jordan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like
I remember.
Like the Michael Jordan of the academy or intellectual life or something, right? But he also includes the observation, you know, probably from Bloom, maybe it was his own creation, but in the mouth of Ravelstein, he has the character say that it was jazz and basketball were the two great Black African-American contributions to American life.
Yeah.
And you get the sense it's this very like physicalized,
totally.
Right? Like
fetishized.
I just thought that line was telling.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Or that passage in Ravelstein, I should say.
Yeah, I think maybe to conclude on closing, there is a sort of interlude in the last section of the book that's called The 60s, where you get a sense of where all of these animosities and fixations came from. Bloom was teaching at Cornell in 1969 when Black Radicals, Black Panthers, took over a student association there. In his view, sort of intimidated with guns the staff into adopting sort of more student control over the nature of the education. And for Bloom, this is like clearly like a traumatic experience that informs all of his ideas about race and education.
Yes.
I don't think it's particularly sophisticated and we don't have to get into it, but you can imagine, I mean, we've talked about neocons, like the Black radicalism in the 60s was the thing that sort of turn them, turn them toward preoccupations with the urban crisis and with some kind of ongoing conflict between a Black radical tradition and this sort of integrationist pulse of previous immigration.
But that's something he shared with Bello. I mean, from everything I know about Bello.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. The last thing about closing, the part three on the university is really the best part of the book, which is when he really gives his account of this thing we've been talking about, the necessity of the university as this space in a democracy, cultivating, you know, basically providing a safe space for aristocratic pursuits. And it's definitely, if you're going to read the book and you don't want to read all the bullshit, I would recommend that third section. The 60s portion is less good, but in the beginning, he's talking about Tocqueville and democracy. He talks about Plato and he talks about Rousseau, and it's very good. And this is where he gives his sort of final plea for what kind of university he wants, what kind of student he thinks it should cultivate. And, you know, in a part that I doubt many of his conservative fans in that era really got to was where he's vicious about like MBA programs. Business degrees, where he's just, you know, he's just saying like, you know, the university is being reduced to this thing that churns out unreflective, acquisitive bourgeois, people who don't have any attachment to their community, their regime, and so on, in ways that are true. And it's very compelling. But I do think we should turn to Ravelstein.
The transition's natural because Ravelstein begins with Bloom in the full flowering of the success of Closing.
Yeah.
And we mentioned this, but I mean, I remember years ago, Sam, the copy of Closing I had at the top of it, it says over 500,000 copies sold. And I bought that 15 years ago. So it basically turned Bloom into a millionaire.
Right.
And brought him a lot of notoriety. He was on Firing Line. Was he on Oprah?
Probably. I don't know.
You know, that kind of prominence. You know, being asked to give lectures everywhere. So that brought in more money too, right? Once you're a prominent lecturer, you can really rake in the money giving talks at various colleges and universities, you know, in front of different groups. So that's where Ravelstein picks up with. Just again, for some background, Closing came out in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
Bloom dies then in 1992. And Ravelstein comes out in 2000.
Right.
Now, part of what's covered in the novel is part of the book's origin story because there's a interesting piece, I think, Sam, we both read by D.T. Max, the author of the mediocre biography of David Foster Wallace. But in 2000, for New York Times Magazine, he wrote a piece called With Friends Like Saul Bellow.
Yeah.
And it's about the kind of aftermath of Ravelstein's publication.
Right.
And this is, I'll just read from this New York Times Magazine piece. So after Bloom's death, for several years, Bello temporized about writing about his friend. He had health problems of his own. Besides, he couldn't find the angle. Encomia were not, as he would say, his racket. He worked on other things. And then in 1993, he and Janice, his then wife, moved to Boston. 2 years later, the couple went to St. Martin on a vacation, and Bello almost died from a toxin he ingested in some red snapper. And he says this, "I was nine-tenths gone," because Bello allowed himself to be interviewed for this piece. "I was nine-tenths gone," he told me. "When he regained his strength, he got to work on Ravelstein. By 1998, he completed a draft of the manuscript." Right. So, you know, we mentioned the theme of death and maybe some of Bloom's own, at least in Ravelstein, some hesitations we see about what the nature of life after death is, or right. if there is life after death. And it was interesting that Bello's own brush with death is what kind of jolted him into actually writing this after years of not being sure he would be able to.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, fundamentally, Ravelstein is primarily an account of their friendship in the years when he's dying. He has a series of illnesses. Mm-hmm. And in the text of the book, I think as we've talked about in the podcast before, Bloom dies of AIDS explicitly, complications from AIDS. Though at the time that Ravelstein came out, there was a lot of controversy about, well, for one, among some people, the fact that he had outed him as a gay man, but also there was some question about whether he had actually died of AIDS, because that wasn't necessarily in evidence. There was at least one sort of doctor friend of Bloom who said that he did not. But of course, we don't really know, right? I mean, I don't know if there's been subsequent information about it, but it was definitely a part of the controversy that for Bello, it's crucial for his novelistic narrative that Bloom die of AIDS. He mentions that in his conversation with D.T. Max, even as he's admitting that he wasn't entirely sure that was what was going on. But it's not necessarily for sure that that's what happened.
In the D.T. Max piece we've been discussing, Nathan Tarkov, who was a longtime University of Chicago professor, and actually, it says here in the piece, is the son of Bello's old friend, Oscar Tarkov, doesn't believe Bloom died of AIDS. Tarkov was Bloom's medical executor and present during his final days. And then Tarkov says, "The word AIDS was never mentioned when Alan died," he said. "I think I would have known." Then the doctor who signed Bloom's death certificate, Nicholas Davidson, considers the matter, the cause of death, quote, "pretty much irrelevant." Mm-hmm. "Bloom was a man who was in heart failure, kidney failure," he said. "The body was winding down." And then Michael Wu, who is Nicky in the novel, Bloom's partner, boyfriend, whatever, was constantly at Bloom's side, but did not want to revisit Bloom's death with a reporter. "It's fiction, not a biography," is all he would say of the matter.
Yeah.
I just want to say that the Tarkov line, the word AIDS was never mentioned when Alan died. I mean, that's proof
it was
nothing
yeah.
in 1987.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, the silence around this and the embarrassment or shame.
Yeah.
You know, it's not at all surprising that Bloom didn't, you know, look his friend in the face and say he was dying of AIDS, if indeed he did.
He wasn't even an out gay man.
Right. At one point in one of the profiles that Bloom I read, one of his former students described his sexuality as "don't ask, don't tell."
It was Wolfowitz.
Wolfowitz, yes. Yeah. But then the doctor saying, well, the cause of death is pretty much irrelevant.
Yeah.
It seems consistent with dying of AIDS, but that was a major controversy.
Yeah.
A lot of Bloom's friends, again, the ones quoted here in the New York Times piece, were upset with Bello for like outing him.
Especially those of his friends who were conservatives. I mean, he was a great hero to conservative
yes.
intellectuals who were not eager to continue aligning themselves with gay man who died of AIDS.
Totally. So Ravelstein begins with Bello and Bloom, Ravelstein and Chick, in Paris.
Yeah.
And it's a lovely scene because Bloom, now in his wealth, got to stay at the same hotel as Michael Jackson.
Yes.
And just the descriptions of Bloom are wonderful. The picking up on the little details, like the gossipy nature of Bloom. I love they were eating breakfast in his big suite at the hotel in Paris, and Bloom saying, you know, the waiter told me that Michael Jackson refuses to eat what the chef prepares here because Michael Jackson has his own chef who travels with him everywhere. And of course, this French chef, as Bloom put it, his nose was bent out of shape over this. And he, you know, quotes the chef saying something like, you know, "I've prepared meals for shahs and kings and prime ministers and presidents, and Michael Jackson won't eat my food." This is all happening as Bloom's sitting there in a silk kimono that he got from after giving a lecture in Japan. And so you just get Bloom in this kimono, smoking, his hand shaking, him stuttering, him gossiping about Michael Jackson, laughing about, you know, the money he has in Paris with his friend Bello. The novel begins just in a incredibly engrossing way, but it's all sort of fueled by all the money Bloom has now from the success of his book.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the things that Bello draws out in his depiction of Bloom, but which everyone who knew him knew too, is that he has this taste for luxury, and he had expensive tastes long before he was able to afford them. And there's, yes. You know, an implication of a sort of tension between Bloom's, I don't know, like we've sort of problematized his democratic commitments, but they are expressed in his work, and he has this critique of the sort of like the American who's obsessed with continental ideas and luxuries. And of course, Bloom in his life is a great unapologetic appreciator of those luxuries. And that's something that Bello mm-hmm. draws out, but very lovingly, you know. It's not like there's no hypocrisy.
No, it's some of the great descriptions are of the money Bloom owed to graduate students even, or like a really expensive Japanese tea serving set. Like he gave one of his students as collateral for the $5,000 loan the student gave him.
Wow.
Basically, before Bloom struck it rich, it was this Byzantine series of like loans and collateral and anything to keep the money flowing for him to finance this lifestyle he couldn't really afford.
There's a wonderful description of what might have attracted Bello to Bloom as a character, as a protagonist. I mean, it's a character in his fiction, from Luc Menon's review of Ravelstein in the New York Review of Books.
Oh, uh-huh.
He talks about how Bello's fiction, there are a lot of people who have to accommodate themselves to the modern world in different ways. And for Bello, there are these sort of, they're the inner city hustlers, and their white counterparts who are lawyers and gangsters, who basically are like Nietzschean Ubermensch, who like see through the rationalizations of the modernity, and live their life according to their own desires. But then there are the people who tend to be the heroes in Bello's books, who are just pained and sickened by modernity. This is from Menand. He says, "There are the lonely and self-conscious maladaptives, the sensitives whom modern life makes sick. They can't help it, who react by building mad theoretical treehouses, which they try to inhabit at the cost of enduring the rest of their generation's contempt for the refusal to flatter the present." So if people have read Bello, that's like Humboldt, you know, that's, you know, these intellectual figures who are trying to adapt themselves to modernity, and it sickens them. Now, Menand says sort of what was so compelling about Bloom for Bello potentially is that he was, quote, "a mad treehouse builder and a gangster at the same time. He was thoroughly disenchanted with the modern world and thoroughly at home in it. A man who spent the millions he made from the publication of a cultural jeremiad on wall-mounted television screens, high-end audio systems, four-star hotel rooms, and Armani suits. He was a philosopher who air-expressed his neckties to Paris for cleaning. He was an atheist who regarded the fear of death as a contemptible bourgeois hang-up, and he was a homosexual. He short-circuited the entire Belovian scheme. It is not surprising that Bello found him completely fascinating. He must not have known entirely what to make of him." And I think that is pretty good. I mean, that certainly those two aspects of Ravelstein, aka Bloom, are powerfully represented in the book and not entirely reconciled.
Yeah, I thought one of the interesting comments in the D.T. Max piece we've mentioned is that, you know, in the novel, Ravelstein goads Chicky, Bello, to be as hard on me as you like. And it's one of the opinions, I think it's sort of voiced by Adam Bello, who's a famous book publisher, Saul Bello's son, that, you know, sure, Bello might have outed his friend or, you know, revealed certain details that weren't always flattering. But on the whole, you have this memorable portrait of a remarkable man. And in the final analysis, isn't that kind of the greatest compliment you can pay someone?
Yeah.
I think it was described as like teasing out their inner essence. Like if you or I knew Bloom, Sam, we would pick up on what Bello describes, but it might not be immediately clear. Right. And that Bello kind of has like reached into Bloom and pulled out like the most fascinating version of his inner essence.
Yeah.
And that includes some of his foibles and flaws.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think sort of one of the central questions in the book is, what is it that Chick, a.k.a. Bello, sees in Ravelstein, a.k.a. Bloom? And what is it that Ravelstein sees in Chick? Why do they become such close friends? What do they get from their friendship, their companionship that they are missing in the rest of their lives? And why does this bond last until, you know, Ravelstein's very final moments?
That's a good question. And it's one, you know, I have some different thoughts on. I'm conflicted about in certain ways, too. For listeners, I just want to say the novel Ravelstein's pretty short, right? Around 200 pages, a little over.
Yeah.
It's a Roman Aklef. It's novella. So in terms of plot, you know, a lot of it is amazing descriptions of Ravelstein.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a true portrait of him. And so, you know, as we discuss it, there's not a lot of plot details to give in some ways. But to get to your question, Sam, which, you know, is what I've been thinking about a long time, there's a few things going on. One is, I do think Bellows, I mentioned earlier that they both responded to their Jewishness in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Bellows' approach to it retained some fascination for Bloom.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, even from a, you might say, Socratic standpoint in the Symposium, right? The idea that we're searching for our other half.
Right.
Right, that the gods, Zeus cuts us in two. Eros is the longing we have for our other half, to, for completeness.
Right.
I'm not suggesting, you know, Bello and Bloom were the other's other half. You know, they weren't in a romantic relationship. You know, they were friends. But I do think the duality there helped.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, the they weren't simply thinking identically about everything. I mentioned one was a philosopher, one was a novelist. There, those dualities, even the age difference between them a bit, I think, you know, those things can make friendships work.
Yeah.
Right? When there's a balance or some duality or some way in which the other friend, their interests overlap but are not identical. And so it leads to fruitful conversations. And you get the sense, too, from the D.T. Max profile I've been reading, that Bello loved the conversations with Bloom.
Right.
And in fact, Bloom sometimes said, you know, they were exhausting.
He's wearing me out.
Yes, Bello would come over and, you know, they would just start into the Peloponnesian War or whatever it might
yeah.
be. So I think that's at work. But in terms of the novel or the novella, again, we see Bloom die. Ravelstein die of AIDS. And then, you know, we see later on, Bello, as mentioned, in real life, he got sick from eating a fish that was improperly prepared, like a poison, and almost died himself. And I've always thought there was something to be made of the kind of juxtaposition or dual images of Bloom on his deathbed with his boyfriend there buying cars. Like he put in an order, a very specific order for a certain kind of
BMW,
right?
For Nikki. And
for Nikki, yes. Whereas Bello, he's portrayed, it's his new wife, right? So one of the things that happens in the novel is Bello moves from wife 4 to 5.
So basically, he's married to Vela in the novel, who's a very well-regarded physicist and a sexual powerhouse who sort of torments the Bello character, Chick, in various ways. Ravelstein despises her and convinces him in various ways to leave her. I mean, like, he thinks that she's a noxious impact on his life. There's a lot to unpack there. But then he marries Rosamund, who is his fifth wife, who's younger. She was a student of Bloom's. She was a student in real life, student of Bloom's. In the novel, a student of Ravelstein's, who is way more, she's doting. She cares for him and does everything that he sort of needs as an elderly man at this point, in a way that his previous wife basically refused to submit.
So I've always thought that there was something about that juxtaposition that was interesting to me. Kind of the underlying anxiety of Bloom, you know, actually dying, and as he's dying, worrying about buying his boyfriend a fancy car.
Yeah.
Versus the kind of more simple devotion, in a way, of Bello's wife to him. And he recovers.
Yeah.
And I've never been sure what to make of it. I might be overplaying it. I mean, I think there's a bit of an Athens and Jerusalem thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, given again, if we take them both as like ideal types representing certain traditions in a way, you know, but I think that is part of it, or maybe lurking there. But this time around, I noticed, I mean, this is kind of Straussian, the way the book begins, you know, Strauss's line about the surface holding the heart of things. I noticed, I'd never thought about this much, but the novel begins this way. Odd that mankind's benefactors should be amusing people. In America, at least, this is often the case. Anyone who wants to govern the country has to entertain it.
Yeah.
During the Civil War, people complained about Lincoln's funny stories. So that quote is how the novel begins. And it struck me that it sets out like the theme of democracy in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Like what are the prospects for greatness, intellectual, political, and otherwise, in a country where entertainment is so
right
embedded in the culture and so necessary for political success? And I've just, you know, because he goes from there, it's a very kind of strange way to start. There's that quote I just read, and then he talks about H.L. Mencken and William Jennings Bryan, and then you kind of meet Ravelstein.
Right.
And I've been thinking about that this latest reading.
Hmm.
Because that's such a theme of closing the American mind, I just wondered what Bellows starting with this little riff on like entertainment and democracy is. And in a way, if, you know, it's kind of a signal that he's blowing this character Ravelstein up into almost cartoonish proportions to like better reveal, you know, this man's character and genius.
Right.
But to sell that, he has to create this character called Ravelstein.
Right.
Right. That is in some ways based on the man, but also a fictionalized, exaggerated version of him.
He's literally larger, right?
Yes, he's literally larger. And I don't have a extremely well thought out take on what that might all mean or imply, but that's what I noticed this time through. I noticed the opening setup about democracy and entertainment. And then I did notice again, as I mentioned at the end, at least as recorded in the novella, you know, Ravelstein's kind of hedge about life after death at the end.
Yeah. There's so much there. I mean, I totally agree. I think that kind of opening, I forgot that that's how the novel opens. It really does, it kind of is an effort that's moderately successful to kind of reconcile these twin Ravelsteins or these twin Blooms. I remember, this is funny, when I worked at Unite here, was an intern at Unite here, the Hotel Workers Union, I remember they also have universities, like Yale is mostly all Unite here. And one of the guy who was the president of Unite here at the time would say that universities are also just hotels. They have housekeeping, you know, people who work in the kind of trades, and then they have entertainment, and the entertainment are the professors. And I think in a way that like that Bellow kind of successfully represents in Ravelstein, he makes that not into an insult to Ravelstein, that he's an entertainer and a teacher.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's one of those moments where it's a kindness to his friend to sort of relate those things. I mean, he does it again when he sort of shows how Ravelstein is sympathetic to Michael Jackson. You know, he's uh-huh. like into the fact that he's staying in the same hotel as Michael Jackson, even though he's been so vitriolic about rock music in his book. But then I think this question that you pointed to about Ravelstein's death and Chick Bellows' near death is really important, not just in the Athens Jerusalem thing, which you can see it, you know, it's a neat little way of understanding what's going on there, but also it's a place where Bellow sort of fails as a novelist because Nicky, who is in effect, like at this point in his life, Ravelstein's husband, Ravelstein's partner in life, you know, his mm-hmm. sexual partner and the person who is his heir, right? It's repeated over and over and over again in the novel that Nicky is Ravelstein's heir. I tried to sort of find all the times in which Bellow defined the relationship between Nicky and Ravelstein. He says, "Nobody questioned the strength of Nicky's attachment to Abe Ravelstein. Nicky was direct by nature, a handsome, smooth-skinned, black-haired, oriental, graceful, boyish man." Another time he says, "He put in very long hours doing errands, taking phone calls. It was Nicky, not the nurses, who shaved Ravelstein with the electric razor while Ravelstein, eyes shut, lolled back his head to lift his chin." He says, "Nicky, Ravelstein's Chinese son, who has nothing to do with all these conversations," meaning their big, highfalutin, intellectual conversations, "was there mm-hmm. to wipe his face. Nicky, Ravelstein's heir and his chief mourner. Nicky was in a special sense family. If Ravelstein had a family, it would be an exotic one because he had no use for families. Nicky, the handsome Chinese prince, would inherit." This is the way that Bellow characterizes Nicky. So it's clear that he's not denying the importance of their bond. Totally. He's not denying that for Ravelstein, Nicky was the only natural person to leave his recently created wealth. But at the same time, there's this thing that that I think Bello really misses, which is this is the AIDS crisis in the late 1980s when so many men were dying of AIDS and they had a partner there who took care of them in all of their abjection. Mm-hmm. And, yes. and stood at their side and wiped their asses and shaved their chins and did all this stuff, which was the purest and most inspiring expression of love you can possibly imagine. And I think Bello does not see it. He doesn't see it.
No. I mean, you're getting at the affection he realizes between them. But I think you're right, too, the constant use of the term heir.
Yeah.
It makes it more like a transaction or like a legal arrangement than a true love or something.
I think it's that. It's the transactionism, and it's kind of rooting it back in Athens, rooting it back in a sort of unequal relationship between a teacher and a student, uh-huh. between somebody who has something to give and someone who has something to receive, as opposed to a bond, which Bello depicts in Nikki's acts of sacrifice. Despite him being like also characterized as this like very sort of like precise, like clean, kind of emotionally distant, slightly like figure, he's there at his side all the time. He's doing all the difficult things. He's dealing with all the bullshit. He's dealing with all the acolytes who come who Ravelstein doesn't want to see. He's doing it all. You know, he's doing all the dirty work. And in those actions, if you a different kind of novelist, different kind of observer, a different kind of friend might have seen something different, you know, might have seen the kind of things. I mean, I think one of the reasons this is in my head is I just watched Angels in America for the first time on HBO. And and there's a big part of that story, which is about this phenomenon, you know, it's about the fact that people are dying. These men are dying. And many of them have somebody there, somebody who's at their side doing this just completely thankless work out of love. Uh-huh. And there's a line where Bello, sort of describing something that Ravelstein has sort of said to him, says that love that bears it out even to the edge of doom is not a modern project. Sort of describing what is one of the Bloom's complaints about his students or complaints about the modern university. But what is love that bears it out even to the edge of doom but the kind of care that was provided to men dying of AIDS by their partners, who hospitals didn't want to recognize as their legitimate partners, who society didn't care for, who were dying of a disease that many people, including people who were thought of themselves as allies of Bloom, thought that they deserved to die from. And that's love that bears it out at the edge of doom. And I think Bello missed it.
That's a great point, Sam. Well, you know, one thing, since we're talking about Bloom's death, I believe it's his last book. I mean, his last new material, you might say. I there's a collection of his essays called Giants and Dwarfs that came out. I'm not sure when, but those were essays he'd written over the years. But his book, Love and Friendship, which is really one of my favorites of his, it's a phenomenal book, actually. I mean, the title gives away its great themes. But, you know, there's chapters on Rousseau and Montaigne and Plato on love and friendship. And I believe it was this book that he essentially was dictating to his students as he was on his deathbed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure about all the details. Maybe some of it had been written before and he was, you know, going over proofs or corrections or adding new material on his deathbed. But I believe that was confirmed to me by a friend of mine who was a Straussian, who very early in his graduate career, Bloom was still alive. Like when my friend first landed at UChicago at the committee, I think Bloom was still alive. And so he described, you know, these students gathering,
yeah, right,
you know, and kind of listening to the master's, you know, final thoughts, final testament in a way. And I just wanted to read the beginning of Love and Friendship because Bloom is amazing on both. I mean, I love him, especially on Friendship.
If we haven't made this clear, he really is a wonderful writer.
Yes. And I especially love him on Friendship via Montaigne. But this is the introduction of Love and Friendship, and it's called Introduction, The Fall of Eros. And it begins this way. This book is an attempt to recover the power, the danger, and the beauty of Eros under the tutelage of its proper teachers and knowers, the poetic writers. Against my will, I have to use the term Eros, in spite of its alien and somewhat pretentious Greekness, as well as its status as a buzzword since Freud and Marcuse. You know, and he goes on to say, the word love now applies to almost everything except the overwhelming attraction of one individual for another. And sex is a timid, pseudo-scientific word that tells us only that individuals have certain bodily needs. And the book ends, it kind of goes in reverse order from Rousseau back to Plato. And it ends with his great essay, The Ladder of Love, on Plato's Symposium.
Yeah.
So it's even on his deathbed, this is what he was thinking of.
Right. There's a line from that book that I pulled out, which I think could also be the kind of epigraph for Ravelstein, where Bloom writes, "Love and friendship each make a demand of loyalty and exclusivity that is likely to bring them into conflict."
Yes. I mean, Bloom's, especially when he's writing about Montaigne, he really gets the sense of the way friends are attracted to each other, even if that's not like a sexual or physical attraction necessarily. With Montaigne, he might have been in love with Laboite. I don't know. But there's the great line from Montaigne's essay memorializing his friend, where he says, "You know, because it was he, because it was I."
Yes.
Right? Like this sense of almost falling into friendship and meeting someone you become friends with in a deep and profound way. And it's different than romantic love or sex or whatever. But it is an attraction.
Yes.
And Bloom gets to the way he's so good on the way that's a political problem, because it means when you're friends, you're more than a citizen.
Yeah.
And he's thinking especially of ancient politics.
Right.
But, you know, when two friends are in a corner of a bar, what are they doing? What are they talking about? It's your own little society in a way, and therefore a threat to the larger society.
Yeah.
You know, are they conspiring? What are they plotting? What are they planning? And I think, you know, one of the great things Bloom can teach us, gosh, this is the most positive we've ever been about some of the podcast, maybe. But when I would teach, say, I mentioned Father Shaw at Georgetown, sometimes when he, in his later years, he you know, was in poor health, and he would have some of us graduate students lecture for him. And I remember he had me lecture on books 8 and 9 of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics on friendship. And, you know, a week or two later, he was in the department, and I stopped by his office to see how he was doing and talked to him. And I said, well, you know, Father Shaw, I talked about the ethics, but I contrasted it some with Montaigne on friendship.
Right.
Because I think, what's the worst thing you can say to someone these days? Let's just be friends.
Yes.
Right? It's like an insult. But friendship, you know, for someone like Bloom and some of the ancients and others, you know, was like a title to be valorized,
right.
A true friend.
Yes.
And Father Shaw was very upset at me because I said, Father, I have to admit, I'm taken by Montaigne's kind of non-instrumental account of friendship where it's kind of based in delight.
Yes.
And Father Shaw wagged his finger at me and he said, no, friendship is about virtue. Siding with Aristotle over Montaigne.
Certainly not true in my opinion.
But I really have to admit, I still find Bloom very powerful to read on love and friendship.
Yes.
You get the sense that, I mean, it's dangerous in a way.
Yeah.
To be playing around with Eros.
Yeah.
And especially, I think, in the era in which we live now, you know, when it comes to professors, there's a creepy, bad way of engaging these things. But I do think it's fundamentally true that sometimes the way ideas in a person you're talking about those ideas with, there is something charged about it.
Yes.
You know, and Bloom was alive to that and alive to the thrill of intellectual discovery, alive to the thrill of reading some of these old texts and finding in them things you know, never thought about before.
Yeah.
You know, so I think Bloom's power as a teacher at its best comes through in everything we've been reading, in Ravelstein, in Closing, in Love and Friendship.
Yeah.
I mean, how remarkable a person do you have to be to have a whole novella written about you?
By Saul Bellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
I totally agree. I mean, I'm sympathetic to the sort of critique. I thought, our friend Corey Robin has a good piece about the recurring theme of the erotic professor that comes up every once in a while,
uh-huh.
often as a way of apologizing for the bad behavior of professors in relation to their students. But I think there is no question that in friendship and in sort of intellectual intersubjectivity, the status of Eros is extremely important. Like you that feeling where you're like, I just can't wait to go talk to this person because it's going to be great. You know, it's going to feel really good. We're going to feel like we're breaking new ground. And even if we're not, it's kind of like the thing that's being built between two people that is to be valued. And I think that, I think Bellow does do a good job of capturing that. In a way, he captures friendship better than he captures love. And I think that they encountered things in each other that they felt that they were missing in themselves. I mean, it's clear that Bellow has kind of always been sort of on the outskirts looking in of a kind of sophisticated intellectual culture, which he would write about, but mostly as an observer and a sort of an appreciator for details, so sort of psychological and emotional detail. Though he could be a good synthesizer of various ideas, his preoccupation was more with the human and the local in particular. But he loved, as we mentioned, he loved to talk for hours about Rousseau and Plato. And, you know, I think that having a person in his life that ignited that part of himself was what attracted him to Bloom. And I think, as we've referred to earlier, I think with Bloom, the status of Bello as the observer, as someone who could tell him a story about an interaction he had, it's so precise, so emotionally and psychologically precise, that he would derive joy from it, the way that he would derive joy from like a great Borscht Belt joke. Like, it was this very Jewish rooted specificity and texture that I think that he still had a great amount of affection for, even if he had in some ways in his own mind transcended in his life. And I think it's notable that he goes back to Jewish metaphysics at the end of his life, that he wants to talk to Bello not only about the afterlife as he conceives it, but also about the Holocaust. And that he keeps going, as his own extinction is looming, he thinks about, what does it mean that I have thought? What does it mean that the figures who I have engaged with my whole life, what does it mean that the sort of thought that has created Western civilization also created the moment where people like me, people who thought those things, desired our extinction too? That's like the conversation he wants to have with Chick at the end of his life over and over and over again. And I think, like, in some ways, a cheap way to describe this, and I don't think it's sufficient, but we'll never get to the bottom of it, but like, I think like Jewishness is a interesting middle variable in their relationship, because it has a rich moral world, right? It has the Old Testament. It has justice as a fundamental principle. And it has this particularity born of a particular set of experiences in the New World, but also when people are always trying to kill you, you have to think pretty practically about how to navigate the world. You can't live entirely in abstraction. And so the figure of the Jew is like this middle space between the philosophical abstraction that drew Bello to Bloom, but also between the like very narrow and down-to-earth, textured, particularistic Jewishness that drew Bloom to Bello.
Yes. No, that's a really interesting point, Sam, because as you were talking and you mentioned that in Ravelstein, Abe Ravelstein, as he nears death, returns to the Holocaust, right? And, you know, there's a way in which Bloom's whole project, as the subtitle of Closing indicates, that education is failing democracy. And you kind of wonder if, despite all his protests about preferring Athens over Jerusalem, right, being a student of the Greeks, being a student of the history of political philosophy, at the end of the day, maybe his project really was to make sure another Holocaust didn't happen.
Yes.
Because student souls, you know, people like him were guiding their souls.
Yes.
And liberating them from certain prejudices and, you know, doing what was necessary for the preservation of democracy. However, you know, you want to define that or argue about what that meant precisely for Bloom. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but it, you know, to be concerned for the fate of democracy as a Jew in the second half of the 20th century, you just can't talk about that or think about it without the backdrop of the Holocaust.
Yeah, exactly.
It was certainly a presence for Leo Strauss's teacher too, who was a
refugee,
exile from Germany.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, it kind of is this weird wrinkle on the thing we've talked about with conservatives before, where some of them who are much less sophisticated, they're constantly sort of like suggesting that this or that new teaching, this kind of continental philosophy, this cultural Marxism, this or that, this import, this identity politics, this or that, is going to lead inevitably to the camps or the gulag. And it's very unsympathetic when people who are full of shit say it, you know? But through Bloom's thought, whether or not you follow every twist and turn of it, and whether it actually works for you, and whether he's not entirely right, and whether it cashes out negatively, and in some ways it does in practical politics, because mostly conservatives love him, you can see the path, right? You can see the path from relativism, the abandonment of Rousseau and Locke, the abandonment of, you know, fundamental truths,
natural right
mm-hmm. to, you know, right-wing Nietzscheanism, you know, relativism of value and a relativism of truth. While we ought to be very suspicious of those conservatives who more or less use the very same kind of affective posture, structure of argument to basically do the opposite, you know, like to defend unjust aspects of our society. It's not incomprehensible. It's not implausible why someone like Bloom, following Strauss, would think that there's something that needs to be preserved from bourgeois liberal democracy, in the absence of which, without it being rooted in a set of ideas, it can produce mass genocide calamity of the 20th century.
Yes. Bloom is an ambivalent figure in the history of conservatism. I mean, I get what you're saying, Sam. It's there. Like, you can understand why conservatives grabbed onto him and why this book was such a event. But also, I think if you read Bloom carefully, he's just harder to put into certain boxes.
Yeah.
You know, as we've gotten at, you know, in some ways, the critique he levels resonates with a lot of conservatives, but I'm not sure the solution does in some ways. And maybe in a bonus episode, we'll talk more about some of the reactions to Bloom.
Yeah.
We can't get into it here, but like that, the closing has had a interesting afterlife.
Right.
And, someone like Patrick Deneen, who we've talked about on the show before, one thing we read but did not discuss yet is his very critical essay about Bloom.
Right.
Some conservatives don't like Bloom. I think they've picked up on some of the ambivalences. And in fact, the way you can read him as a interesting defender of liberalism in certain ways,
yes.
right? Or at least certain forms of liberalism. Right. So, you know, I think this was... I've loved talking about Bloom because I think he's fascinating. I love reading Ravelstein.
So good.
If any of our listeners need a summer... beach read
or
even just a quick read, because it's fairly short, again about 200 pages, you know, I highly recommend it. Again, we didn't want to give a book report, and you know, we read from it just enough to give you a sense of how great the writing is and what an evocative portrait of Bloom Bello provides in Ravelstein.
Yes.
And I suspect we'll pick up with some of this again.
Yeah.
But Bloom has long interested me. If you want to see him in action, you can go on YouTube and the episode of Fireline he did with Bill Buckley is available.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it's great because another one of our bête noirs, Midge Dector, is the like examiner like referee or something.
Right.
So it's like Buckley and then Bloom like smoking cigarettes on and off throughout the show. And then
Midge Dector
standing off to the side in this like weird 80s red dress. Big glasses on, you know, occasionally firing questions at both or one of them.
A formidable conservative intellectual in her own right, but for listeners of the podcast, she's also was Norman Podoritz's wife.
She is Norman Podoritz's wife.
Yes, still today, yes. I think we've given everyone more than enough to chew on. I think these guys are endlessly fascinating, and Ravelstein's very much worth reading. As is closing, I mean, I mentioned it earlier, but you know, you'll roll your eyes at a bunch of it, but then you'll get like a pretty fascinating, you know, miniature version of the kind of lecture I imagine he would give to his class. That's just kind of thrilling in its references and the quickness of his mind and the eloquence of his writing.
It's so amazing it was a bestseller.
No, it's insane.
Yeah, it's like every piece you read about it calls it an unlikely bestseller.
Yeah.
It's one of those cases where the cliche is true.
It's true, but I also think I think a lot of pieces also mention that like a lot of conservatives sort of bought it because it was like a thing to have on your bookshelf, but I don't think everybody read it. I think they read the mean parts about Mick Jagger and black students and called it a day. Because the section that's like about how you get from Socrates to Heidegger, it's so dense. I mean, it reads like quickly and clearly, but it's philosophically pretty complicated. I can't imagine like a bunch of like fired up troglodytic like young Republicans reading it and being like, yeah, this is our Bible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Frankly.
No, very true. Shall we wrap it up soon?
Yeah, let's wrap it up so we can go get dinner and then talk to each other more.
Yes, right. Have our own little symposium over wine.
Yeah, right.
Well, thanks, Sam. Thank you, listeners. Hope you enjoyed this episode, and see you next time.
See ya. Goodbye.
All right. Sweet.